KPFT FM HD2, Houston. KPFT.
Mike Onig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. The segues may be jarring, but the stories are interesting. Yeah, that was a surprise to Andrew. I'd not done that.
Oh, yeah. Mike, he's not wrong.
I'm not wrong. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there.
As far as I know, we don't have any elections coming up locally. However, you can always go to votetexas.gov and check voter information for your county. And of course, if there are no elections coming up, this is a great time to make sure you're registered or to register, whichever is appropriate for you. Okay, first story from communityimpact.com. City Council, Houston City Council, that is, debate reveals kinks in charter amendment process. When the Houston City Secretary's office finished verifying a petition submitted by organizers that aimed to change the power dynamics at City Hall, the group behind the petition said they did not expect they would have to wait 2 years before their proposal will be up for a citywide vote. By invoking a clause in the state constitution, City Council members were legally able to file the item on the November 2023 ballot, despite an election date approaching this November. The mayor and council members who supported the move cited election costs and a potential low turnout as reasons for the delay. At the same time, the Houston Firefighters Union is awaiting the verification of signatures on their petition submitted to the city's secretary office on July 11th. After Harris County's August 16th election filing deadline passed, it became clear the union's proposition will not go before the voters this fall either. The two missed opportunities for a November election kicked off a debate about Houston residents' access to power at City Hall. Said Kellen Zale, an associate professor at the University of Houston Law Center who specializes in local government law, "You don't want too many elections because that does increase the cost to taxpayers and potentially causes voter confusion, but you want to make sure there's an opportunity for elections to be held in a timely manner." The two petitions aim to alter the city charter in different ways. The first proposal, circulated by a bipartisan group, aims to change the charter so any city council member can place an item on the council's weekly agenda as long as two other members back it. In other words, seconded and thirded, I guess. The effort is supported by wide-ranging groups, including the Houston Democratic Socialists of America and the Harris County Republican Party. As currently written, the charter only allows the mayor to place items on the agenda. The second charter amendment petition, lobbied by the Firefighters Union, proposes a requirement that the union and the mayor enter binding arbitration in the event of an impasse in labor contract negotiations. Unlike the current mediation process, where both parties are legally required to come to an agreement according to the Texas Local Government Code. The effort is the latest in a labor contract dispute between the city and the firefighters union that has resulted in numerous lawsuits and prevented the parties from agreeing to a contract since 2017, which understandably is the reason they might be seeking arbitration. The Texas Constitution allows the city council to choose the soonest possible election date or the sooner of the next mayoral election or presidential election. Houston City Council members debated whether to put the petition on this November's ballot or the November 2023 ballot. The majority ended up choosing the 2023 election date, citing various reasons. Some stated it will be a better turnout because it will also fall on the next mayoral and city council race, and others noted the estimated $1.3 million cost to host an election is too high for one proposition. Lengthy article, but kind of important in terms of local governance. The reasoning for an election delay does make some sense. I can understand a sense among some that it's the equivalent of justice delayed is justice denied. But I think there's also something to be said for such a consequential change in the way the city government works being determined by the heaviest voter turnout possible. Voter fatigue matters, and turnout matters because it depends or it determines how valid the deciding vote is. I still remember that light rail, a multi-billion-dollar, multi-decadal project that changed the city forever, was approved on maybe the third ballot attempt by a light voter turnout, and light rail was approved by a majority of 10% of the voters. Multi-billion-dollar, multi-decadal effort changing the face of the city, a majority of 10% of the voters. So I believe that Houston needed better mass transit. I just don't and didn't think that this was the way to get it. So I think that I understand that the proponents of the petitions involved would like to get decisions by the electorate faster, but I do think there's something to be said about putting it on a ballot where you're more likely to get more people, more of the electorate determining such an important decision. Andrew?
Well, I was going to just say, essentially echo what you said, because the way that the issue is now, I really can't come down on one side or the other. You make the same good points. I think arguably putting these proposals into effect now would get more business done in City Hall, and maybe that would be a good thing. But at the same time, like, yeah, we're going to have a totally low turnout, and so you can't really argue that there's a mandate to put the changes into effect. What I'm thinking now, though, is maybe it might not solve the cost problem, because I suspect that this would be complicated and thus expensive, but I almost wonder if there could be a running sort of referendum on these things that just, like, there's no polling places, like, set up specially or anything like that, but, like, you maybe, you know, get a ballot online, print it out, and mail it in to, like, the city council building, or they have booths set up in the city council building, and over a period of several months or something, so that people have time to sort of research it and then go in and, you know, vote if they care enough, and maybe the turnout will be higher that way. I don't know.
But isn't that just kind of basically what they call running an election?
Yes, but usually elections, the voting period is only a few days or so, really.
No, usually a couple of weeks at least early voting. So you're proposing like several months of early voting.
Yeah, like a very long form voting time election to try and get the maximum turnout possible while spreading the cost over time, so it's less impactful.
But considering the fact that it's already September, I don't think I don't think the city writ large is really ready for the kind of debate that a significant change like this deserves.
Maybe not.
There's printing ballots and mailing ballots and receiving ballots and counting ballots. And people voting early before really enough information has gone out there for a real decision on a serious matter of city business.
That's true, but I'm not sure that that's a problem unique to my idea. I think that's just a problem with democracy in general.
Well, yes, but I think that the timeline is short. It's kind of like British elections where they call like a snap election.
Yeah.
And this is something that's been so far below the radar screen that I don't, you know, it's like when you have a snap election in a parliamentary system, usually the issues have been talked out, the personalities involved are well known. This is not that.
It's essentially a way of saying, we've talked this to death, let's just figure out who wins and let's just go with it.
Yeah, this has barely been born to life, let alone talked to death.
Fair enough.
Okay, next story from communityimpact.com. Redevelopment Authority brings in a $600,000 grant for intersection improvements at Yale and Center Streets. I know, why am I talking about an intersection? But we'll get to that. The improvements will include a new mast arm mounted traffic signal, pavement markings, pedestrian call buttons, and countdown timers, and improvements to make the intersection more in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, according to a news release. The intersection saw 27 crashes between 2017 and 2019, according to the authority, citing statistics from the state's crash reduction information system. That data is part of what officials said prompted them to pursue improvements. This particular intersection is part of the area around I-10 and Heights and Yale and Taylor Street. There's been an enormous amount of development there, an enormous increase in traffic that the streets and intersections were never designed for in that area. It really makes driving difficult. The crash statistics for a city street intersection are high. And of course, talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act, the development has included things like residential condominium developments, high rises. So you have a lot of new residential development there, and it doesn't comply with any reasonable standard for pedestrians, let alone the Americans with Disabilities Act. In a city that has so few sidewalks to start with, you've got to begin somewhere, and I think that this is a worthwhile project, and I think it's worth mentioning because it impacts so many people. Andrew?
Yeah, accessibility is a problem in a lot of places in the U.S., as we may discuss later, and that's no different in Texas cities. I'm glad to see even incremental progress on increasing accessibility.
Okay, next story from CommunityImpact.com. Cypress Creek flood projects on track despite funding challenges. 3 years after voters passed a $2.5 billion flood bond referendum in response to Hurricane Harvey, the Harris County Flood Control District continues to work on flood prevention projects while dealing with funding and land acquisition issues. Experts recommend the district add at least 25,000 acre feet, which is about 8.15 billion gallons of stormwater detention, to the Cypress Creek watershed to alleviate the area's chronic flooding issues. By comparison, the Harris County Flood Control District has constructed about 50,000 acre feet of detention countywide since 1937. Mm-hmm. So a 50% increase on about 75 years of development. And the tax day flood of April 2016 dumped about 240 billion gallons of water on Harris County over 2 days. So, you know, we've got a situation of relative volume here. The district plans to build nearly 20 additional stormwater detention basins in the Cypress Creek watershed with the potential to add nearly 14,000 acre feet of stormwater detention. However, this number is subject to change as the HCFCD has not determined the costs or funding sources for all the detention basins. The 2018 bond does include funds for land acquisition. In addition to detention basins, HCFCD, say that three times fast, has several subdivision drainage improvement projects underway in the watershed. Additionally, the district plans to release phase two studies on the potential for an underground flood tunnel in the Cypress Creek watershed in September for community review. If approved, the project could take 5 or 6 years if the district can secure the billions of dollars needed for construction. FYI, the district that we're talking about is sort of in northern Harris County. The reason I'm talking about things that are hyper-local like this is a goal for this program that I feel is important is to talk about topics that people should know about or might benefit from knowing about, but that maybe don't receive a high profile.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of those things, and I think it's coming at a time when people are hyper aware of flooding, whether it's from storm surge or from rainfall, whether it's tropical storms or hurricanes. I think that it's important to know that, yes, these things are being planned for, and yes, efforts are being made, and construction can only happen so fast, and money has to be found, and land has to be acquired. And when you start talking about things like storm sewer tunnels, that's massive. And I think probably in this area is something that's long overdue. I just feel that this is part of the mission of this show, is for people to be able to hear about stuff that maybe is so buried in the rest of the news items that they never run across it. Yeah. Andrew?
HCFCD, HCFCD, HCFCD. Three times fast.
Your tongue is better than mine.
Anyway,
I'm not going to compete.
We talked last week about the Ike Dike, which is also a plan for severe weather mitigation infrastructure. It's a different type, but it's the same sort of lines. Storm surge.
It's for storm surge rather than runoff.
That project is also having funding issues, and really it's not surprising, as these projects are often huge in scope, but they're necessary, and they build a network of storm defense that benefits citizens, yes, but also businesses, especially all the refineries we have around here. In exchange for protecting life and property and profit, it seems fair to me for corporate tax to be raised to fund the projects, or perhaps companies can generate some goodwill by donating the necessary funds.
Well, you know, they never want to pay the taxes to do the infrastructure until after the infrastructure is needed. Mm. It's kind of the old story about you buy a burglar alarm after your house has been broken into.
Mm.
And the odds of it being broken into again in most neighborhoods are slender, because lightning usually doesn't strike twice in the same place. But you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2. We air on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., and you can hear the show live online at kpft.org, podcast it on your phone's podcast app, or by going to archive.kpft.org. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on show posts and more at the top of the page, find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. We're also on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own social media accounts.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and on Tumblr spelled the same at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Our next story is from ABC13.com. The title of the story, abortion law doesn't need to cover rapes because Texas will eliminate them, Abbott says. You've probably already heard this story, but I just had to cover it. Texas Senate Bill 8 went into effect on September 1st. The bill, which prohibits abortions once a heartbeat can be detected in a fetus, also does not make exceptions for rape or incest. On Tuesday, as Governor Greg Abbott signed the controversial voting bill, he was asked about the lack of a rape exception in the abortion law. He said, quote, "Let's make something very clear. Rape is a crime, and Texas will work tirelessly to make sure that we eliminate all rapists from the street of Texas by aggressively going out and arresting them and prosecuting them and getting them off the streets. So goal number one in the state of Texas is to eliminate rape so that no woman, no person will be a victim of rape." I do note, for starters, he didn't talk about eliminating incestors, if that's a word. This ranks as probably one of the stupidest things I've ever heard any politician say, let alone a governor, or for that matter, any person. And stupid, and Andrew can confirm this, stupid is a word that I use very sparingly. Abbott's goal number one is clearly magical thinking. Maybe his number one goal should be reducing shooting deaths, or fighting the pandemic, or ending voter suppression. You know, stuff he might actually have some control over. Andrew?
Well, you know, I've seen some speculation that Abbott is going to, quote unquote, end rapes by the same method capitalists often use, defining them out of existence. If the law assumes everyone consents, nobody can be charged for non-consensual acts, right? Obviously, this is an unlikely scenario and would rightfully face huge backlash, but honestly, I wouldn't put it past Republicans.
You know, it's not impossible that they'll simply legislate a new definition of rape.
Yeah.
And therefore, they will eliminate rape because it will no longer be defined as sexual assault.
Mm.
Maybe it'll simply be unfair activities by socialists.
Yeah. Blame it on us. Huh?
And that way it won't be a sexual assault problem anymore. It'll be a political assault problem.
Of course. And then that'll be all the excuse they need to take people out in the street and shoot them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, proto-fascist. Meanwhile, Mexico's Supreme Court rules that abortion is not a crime. The key piece of this story for Texans, the decision could potentially open another option for Texas women seeking legal abortions. For years, women in South Texas have crossed the border to go to Mexican pharmacies to buy even with the pronunciation key, I have a problem. Misoprostol, a pill that makes up half the two-drug combination prescribed for medical abortions. Legal abortions could become accessible now along Mexico's long-shared border with Texas. So this raises the question, will Texas Republicans now build a border wall so that Texas women won't be permitted to cross into Mexico? Obviously, that's going to be the reason for the new border wall, as opposed to preventing Mexicans from coming to Texas, because now women will be trying to escape Texas. Andrew?
Well, I'll quickly mention, there are, you know, it's not just cis women who can get pregnant. Trans people can also get pregnant and so also need abortion care sometimes. Just quick mention. But I read something.
I have to stop you there. Have they now progressed to the point where it is possible for a trans woman to have a uterus and get pregnant? Because that is a big scientific advancement I have not heard.
That, not yet. They're working on it. And there are some promising things so far. But I am talking about trans men who may choose to keep that aspect of their bodies.
Okay.
So, good enough. Yeah. But anyway, I read somewhere that the best pro-choice argument for pro-lifers is not about life or fetuses or ethics. It's about government overreach. Do conservatives really want the government to be able to force people to let another person use their body? It starts with forcing pregnant people to carry to term. Where does it end? Forced transplants from you to the governor and state senators? I wouldn't think a freedom lover would want that.
You know, I haven't mentioned this on the show in a while, but several years ago, I came up with a theory. And of course, nothing applies to everyone, okay? But I think that politically speaking, to the extent that politicians are so-called pro-life, it's not so much about being pro-life as it is about being pro-shame.
Yes.
They don't believe in, quote, unquote, inappropriate sex or sexual relations. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to do the crime, essentially, they want you to do the time. Mm-hmm. They want you to go back to the 1950s where pregnant girls had to be hidden in special homes where they gave birth. They want to make sure that if you get pregnant, your, quote, punishment is you now have to raise the child. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the old be fruitful and multiply part of it. And the argument that they might use is, hey, we're actually reproducing at below the replacement rate in most developed countries at this point. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that play into this, but if they were really pro-life, obviously they would be anti-execution, pro-safety net, pro-food stamps, pro-education. They're not any of those things. Therefore, they're not really pro-life. They're just pro-shame and pro-birth.
Yes, exactly.
That's my theory. I haven't heard anyone else put that forward, but, you know, it's there.
I've definitely heard Republicans are pro-birth, not pro-life before. I've heard that. But, yeah, I
the pro-shame thing has not gotten a lot of circulation.
The pro-shame thing is new. Definitely the pro-shame thing. But I agree with you entirely that what they want is social control. And they want their social control specifically.
Their version of right and wrong and appropriate and inappropriate and punishments.
Yep.
Okay. From NPR.org, new studies find evidence of superhuman, and that's in quotes, immunity to COVID-19 in some individuals. Immunologist Shane Crotty prefers hybrid immunity. Over the past several months, a series of studies has found some people mount an extraordinarily powerful immune response against SARS-CoV-2. The coronavirus that causes COVID-19. COVID-19, by the way, means coronavirus ID 2019. Did you know that?
I knew something about it. Like 19 was the year that it was first identified, not the year that it went global.
And I'm only mentioning that because it really hasn't been mentioned since like March of 2020. So I just thought I would remember people.
Yeah.
Their bodies produce those people that have this extraordinary immune response. Their bodies produce very high levels of antibodies, but they also make antibodies with great flexibility, likely capable of fighting off coronavirus variants circulating in the world, but also likely effective against variants that may emerge in the future. So who is capable of mounting this hybrid immune response? People who have had a hybrid exposure to the virus. Specifically, they were infected with the coronavirus in 2020 and then immunized with mRNA vaccines this year. those people have amazing responses to the vaccine, said a virologist at Rockefeller University. I am not going to try to pronounce her name, who also helped lead several of the studies. The antibodies in these people's blood can even neutralize SARS-CoV-1, the first coronavirus, which emerged 20 years ago. That virus is very, very different from SARS-CoV-2. These antibodies were even able to deactivate a virus engineered on purpose to be highly resistant to neutralization, but antibodies in people with a hybrid immunity could neutralize it. These findings show how powerful the mRNA vaccines can be in people with prior exposure to SARS-CoV-2, she says. There's a lot of research now focused on finding a pan-coronavirus vaccine that would protect against all future variants. Our findings tell you that we already have it. But there's a catch, right, she adds. You first need to be sick with COVID-19. After natural infections, the antibodies seem to evolve and become not only more potent, but also broader. They become more resistant to mutations with the virus. Immunologist John Wary at the University of Pennsylvania is a bit more hopeful. In our research, he says, we already see some of this antibody evolution happening in people who are just vaccinated, he says, although it probably happens faster in people who have been infected. So, hope for the future. The body is a remarkable machine. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, there's been fear that COVID might become a recurring illness like the flu. Hopefully this hybrid immunity can prevent that and more people will develop it.
Well, of course, we're talking, if we're talking about the flu, we're talking about not eradicating it, just making it a relatively minor disease that doesn't kill hundreds of thousands of people every year. Okay, next story from the New York Times. Democrats and lobbyists gird for battle over far-reaching tax increases. Congressional committees this week begin drafting tax increases on the wealthy and corporations to pay for a $3.5 trillion social policy bill, but the targets are putting up a fight. On Thursday, the House Ways and Means Committee is set to begin formally drafting its voluminous piece of the 10-year measure to combat climate change and reweave the nation's social safety net with paid family and medical leave, expanded public education, new Medicare benefits, and more. In other words, a pro-life agenda. The committee's purview includes much of that social policy, but also the tax increases needed to pay for it. Corporate interests, led by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, and Americans for Tax Reform, among others, have mobilized a multifaceted lobbying and advertising blitz to stop the tax increases or at least mitigate them. They're lobbying to try to escape their obligation to pay the taxes they owe, leaving working families to pay a larger share of the burden, Mr. Biden said at the White House last Friday. Somebody has got to pay. Many Democrats are determined to tax the wealth of America's fabulously rich, much of which goes untaxed for decades before being passed along to heirs. Currently, for instance, when large estates are passed on at death, heirs are allowed to value the stocks, real estate, and other assets at the price they would fetch at the time of the original owner's death. They pay taxes only on the gain in value from that point once the assets are sold. If the assets are not sold, they are still not taxed at all. Mr. Biden wants to have heirs to large fortunes pay taxes when the original owner dies. Those taxes would be levied on inherited assets based on the gain in value from when those assets were initially purchased. Even more significantly, the Finance Committee is looking at taxing the accumulated wealth of billionaires, regardless of whether it is sold. Extremely wealthy Americans like Amazon founder Jeff Bezos would have a decade to pay a one-time tax on the value of assets like stocks that have been accruing value for years. They would then pay taxes each year on the annual gain in value of their stocks, bonds, and other assets, much like many Americans pay property taxes on the annually assessed value of their homes. Another key component is the international tax code. The Biden administration has called for doubling the tax that companies pay on foreign earnings to 21%, so the United States complies with an international tax deal that the administration is brokering, which would usher in a global corporate minimum tax of at least 15%. Some Democratic lawmakers have expressed concern that U.S. companies would still be at a competitive disadvantage if other countries enacted minimum tax rates as low as 15% and the United States had a higher rate. Republicans are already on the attack. After the disappointing monthly jobs report on Friday, Representative Kevin Brady of Texas, the ranking Republican on the Ways and Means Committee, said the slowing economy would, quote, only get worse if the Democrats' trillions in tax hikes and welfare spending is rammed through Congress in September. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the chairman of the Finance Committee, said he understood that business groups and Republicans would howl that the tax increases would kill jobs, stifle the economy, and hurt ordinary struggling Americans. The big lobbies are going to attack you under any circumstances, he said, and half the time they're just making it up. I'm so glad someone said that. But he insisted that the politics had changed. Americans who struggled during the coronavirus pandemic can see how rich others have become. New revelations from a trove of tax records leaked to ProPublica showed that household names like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk paid virtually no federal taxes. No federal taxes. So they're among the 40% of Americans who don't pay federal income tax, except most of the 40% are actually poor. Administration officials insisted that taxing the rich and corporations would help sell the bill. My observation here, Republicans have spent decades trying to term inheritance taxes as death taxes. They're not death taxes. They're deferred capital gains taxes and generally don't kick in until you're talking about estates. I think the current limit now is like $9 million, which already is like in the 1% threshold.
Yeah, something that most people never reach.
Never reach. Families often never reach that kind of number.
Yeah.
And I have to say, though, I am uncomfortable with taxing unrealized capital gains as part of property taxes on the rich. So in other words, your stock goes up. It's not like property. Property, except for rare occasions in history, property almost always goes up in value. Stocks and bonds, not so much. So it's like if you pay taxes on unrealized capital gains on market commodities, do you then get a rebate on your taxes when they go down? So that's kind of awkward. However, one of the things we learned from the ProPublica revelations on taxes of the rich is that many times the very wealthy manage to avoid capital gains taxes by not selling assets, but by using assets as collateral. So they take out a loan, they collateralize these stocks or bonds or securities, and therefore they never have to pay capital gains taxes on them. Now, I might make an argument as a layperson, I'm not a financier, but once you collateralize those assets, that fixes a value. And I think it's at that point fair to say you bought it here, you collateralized it there, you basically assessed a price or a valuation on it, now it's time to pay a capital gains tax. I think that's worthwhile. As for property taxes, the article makes a reference to Americans paying taxes on their properties. Why shouldn't the wealthy pay taxes on property more broadly defined? I think it's a much simpler prospect to simply say, and I've mentioned this on the show before, let's have progressive property taxes. If you can afford a property worth millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, you can probably afford to pay property taxes at a higher rate than someone with a home worth, say, $250,000 or $500,000 or $1 million. Andrew?
Well, this bill should be a no-brainer, but I could see the Manchin and Sinema wannabes standing in the way in order to put self-made success stories over reality once again.
Are you implying they have no brains?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily saying that.
Just that's had not to pop that in.
Mm. I'd say people should write them letters, make sure this passes, but that assumes that those letters will be read. So,
yeah. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2. We are on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., and you can also hear the show live online at kpft.org, podcast it on your phone app, which is something I strongly recommend, or you can go to archive.kpft.org and listen to past episodes of this show and many, many other programs from KPFT. KPFT is Houston's community station. That means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming, over 100 unique programs. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage and hit the donate button. Pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, large or small or in between, and you could even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Imagine me doing the Vanna White thing right now. You can also donate by texting the word give. You can text G-I-V-E to what used to be our call-in number, 713, maybe again someday, 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. Text the word give. You can also spread the word because word of mouth helps, and it's free. And by the way, any donations are tax deductible if you're in that tax bracket. Mm. Okay. Next story. Sorry, I have to shift papers. From BBC News, the Northern Ireland Protocol, further delays for Irish Sea border checks. Excerpts from the article, the checks are a requirement of the Northern Ireland Protocol, a deal reached by the UK and European Union in 2019. It means that some products need to be checked as they arrive from Great Britain, but grace periods mean that not all the checks have been implemented. What we're talking about here is there was an agreement to kind of make a, what they kind of call a soft border across the Irish Sea between the main part of the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland, which creates a whole mess between the Union and between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And it's just a mess. Anyway, the story goes on. Some of these grace periods were due to expire at the end of September, but the government has now indefinitely extended them. The UK wants a fundamental renegotiation of the protocol, but the EU has said that is not possible, although it is prepared to consider additional flexibilities. Okay, I just have to interrupt myself for a second, because as I was reading that, I suddenly flashed to the movie Alien. I know that this seems counterintuitive, but stay with me here. Do you remember the two engineers that were below decks that maintained the ship, and they were constantly going to the crew and saying, we need to renegotiate our contracts? Essentially, the United Kingdom is the two guys working in the lower decks of the Nostradamus. Nostromo? I think it's the Nostromo. Basically, these are the two mechanics that constantly want to renegotiate their contracts. Anyway, weird correlation. Going on. In a statement on Monday evening, the European Commission said in part that the protocol is an integral part of the withdrawal agreement and the agreed solution between the UK and the EU to the problems caused by Brexit for the island of Ireland. Both sides are legally bound to fulfill their obligations under the agreement. The European Commission said it would not agree to a renegotiation of the protocol. And I'm laughing now because I'm now again imagining the discussions going on in the Nostromo between the engineering crew and the rest of the crew about, we need to renegotiate our contract. This wasn't included in our original agreement. Brexit as what would you call it? Brexit as kind of a metaphor for the movie Alien.
Yeah.
That is something I have never heard anyone else suggest. So you heard it here first.
If it catches on.
It deserves to. It deserves to. Because in Brexit, no one can hear the Scots scream. God. Just saying. To go back to my prepared notes. Brexit was, is, and will continue to be a bad idea, if only because of the strains it puts on the Union part of the United Kingdom. And that isn't the only reason. It harms the British economy and every nation of the Union, it endangers Irish peace, and it diminishes Britain in a geopolitical sense. Brexit is not only the UK shooting itself in the foot, it's the UK not even bothering to get treatment for the gunshot wound. And Alien. Andrew?
Well, I'm going to take this in slightly of a different direction. The arguments for the English to just accept that Ireland isn't theirs anymore and leave just keep piling up. Brexit is just the latest.
I'm going to make a qualified disagreement with that. It is a religious conflict between the Northern Ireland Protestants, who are a majority but not a unitary group, and the Irish Republican Catholics, who also are a majority but are not a unitary group. I read in some previous articles that actually polls of younger Northern Irish are actually finding the idea of union with the Republic less objectionable. Yeah. You know, this is part of that Jack McDevitt quote that I once heard that I cite occasionally, that civilization changes one funeral at a time.
Huh, yeah.
It's entirely possible that over maybe another generation, there will have come to be enough meeting of the minds between the Northern Irish and the Republican Irish that unification might be an option that both sides will consider reasonable and that the UK might ultimately agree to, or perhaps have no choice but to agree to.
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, you know, I respect that religion is a part of the conflict. I think it's more that it is a traditional sort of land and empire conflict that has religion as a complicating factor.
It's a post-colonial issue, basically.
Yeah, it is. And whatever the structure of the issue is, it's post-colonial. And so.
But, of course, it's always easy for us to criticize other nations.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay. Well, for you, it's easy. We're not going to go there. Okay. Can you tell sleep deprivation, folks? Can you? Can you? Okay. From Reuters. Pakistan frets over security threats from neighboring Afghanistan. This is actually a story I wanted to do last week, but we ran out of time. As the story goes, there is growing concern. It's still relevant and it's still true. There is growing concern among Pakistani officials about security in neighboring Afghanistan as the Taliban tries to form a government and stabilize the country following the departure of U.S. and other foreign forces. Islamabad is particularly worried about militant fighters from a separate Pakistani Taliban group crossing from Afghanistan and launching lethal attacks on its territory. Thousands of Pakistanis have been killed in jihadist violence in the last two decades. The next 2 or 3 months are critical, a senior Pakistani official said, adding that Islamabad feared a rise in militant attacks along the Afghan-Pakistan border as the Taliban tried to fill a vacuum left by the collapse of Afghan forces and the Western-backed administration. The source added, "We, the international community, have to assist the Taliban in reorganizing their army in order for them to control their territory." U.S. officials have repeatedly accused Pakistan of supporting the Afghan Taliban, which fought in a civil war in the mid-1990s before seizing power in 1996. Islamabad, one of the few capitals to recognize the Taliban government that was toppled in 2001, denies the charge. The Pakistani official, who has direct knowledge of the country's security decisions, said Pakistan planned to send security and intelligence officials to Kabul to help the Taliban reorganize the Afghan military. The official warned that Islamic State Khorasan, ISIS-K, a loosely affiliated offshoot of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, was actively looking to launch attacks and recruit new fighters. The United States recently launched two drone strikes targeting ISIS-K militants, including one in Kabul and one near the eastern border with Pakistan. The Taliban criticized the strikes as, quote, a clear attack on Afghan territory, which I guess I'd have to agree with them on. Pakistan, whose armed forces also possess unmanned drones as well as conventional aircraft, will avoid intervening directly in Afghanistan if at all possible, the Pakistani official said. The Afghan Taliban have reassured their neighbor they will not allow their territory to be used by anyone planning attacks on Pakistan or any other country. But Islamabad expected the Afghan Taliban to hand over militants planning attacks against Pakistan, the official added, or at least force them from their mutual border where Pakistani troops have been on high alert. You know, the Pakistanis, I think, often are maybe too cagey by half. They seem to make strategically poor decisions. And I think this is an excellent example. They were playing both sides against the middle, helping the United States in Afghanistan, for which, by the way, they were extremely well paid, while also helping the Taliban against the United States and allied forces. The ambition I have been given to understand that the Pakistanis had was that once the Western forces left, they would be able to exercise influence in Afghanistan as kind of a sphere of influence, and that Pakistan would be disunited enough that Afghanistan would be disunited enough that Pakistan would be able to pull tactical and strategic strings. And I think what they're finding is, you know, when you play with cobras, sometimes they bite back.
Mm.
Andrew?
Well, I don't think I'm alone in not wanting the international community to help the Taliban reorganize into a government. First, it would surely make it harder for Afghan civilians to resist the Taliban, which I think is the only way a stable, fair government is going to arise there. And there is some civilian resistance. There's a particular province where the U.S. actually launched its offensive back when the war on terror started. That recently the Taliban has claimed to crush resistance in that area, but the resistance is also – they claimed on Twitter. The resistance is also on Twitter claiming that they're still there. So we don't know yet. Second, if the Taliban does set up a government, they would be in a much better position to attack Pakistan themselves if they wanted to, which is a real possibility in my opinion. I don't blame Pakistan for being nervous, but I don't think trying to prop up the Taliban is a smart reaction.
Well, this brings us to our next story, which is an opinion piece. It was written a couple of weeks ago. It's from a company called MediaCorp, which is Singapore's largest content creator and transmedia platform. That's not an advertisement. That's just a statement for you to evaluate the source. With the fall of Kabul to the Taliban, the U.S. in the 21st century has replicated the ignominious exits by the U.K. in the 19th century and the Soviets in the 20th. The U.S. withdrawal is not all good news for the Chinese government for two reasons. First, the U.S. withdrawal is part of a wider strategic shift in Washington, attempting to end costly campaigns in the Middle East and Afghanistan so that military and geopolitical attention can be focused more intently on the Indo-Pacific. In essence, the U.S. is bringing to an end land campaigns in Asia to better concentrate on the maritime domain in the Western Pacific. Second, the U.S. withdrawal highlights an uncomfortable new reality for Beijing. And as an aside, this also applies to Pakistan and other adjacent countries. For the last 40 years of its remarkable economic development, China has been able to free ride on the U.S. global security presence. Beijing, meanwhile, has had to expend no blood or treasure to benefit from these interventions and could focus domestically on rapidly developing its economy, military, and social cohesion with only brief and limited international security operations. Now that the free ride appears to be coming to an end, the U.S. is withdrawing from Middle East theaters in Afghanistan and Iraq, just as China is growing its commercial interests and presence and interests overseas. Pakistan is a case in point. A suicide bombing in mid-July killed 9 Chinese citizens working on the Dazu Dam in Pakistan, part of CPEC.
China-Pakistan Economic Corridor.
Thank you so much. Another suicide bombing last Friday at the Gwadar East Bay Expressway, another key project in the corridor, injured a Chinese national. China has been a net oil importer since 1993. In 2020, 5 of the top 10 suppliers of oil to China were Gulf states. Securing this vital source of energy is now one of China's key strategic goals, as well as ensuring stability in the oil markets more broadly. As a result, Beijing has steadily been enhancing its security presence in Central Asia and the Middle East. The country's first overseas military base was in Djibouti in 2017 and has since been expanded with an aircraft carrier pier added in April. China, by the way, has, I believe, 1 operational aircraft carrier. I think they have 1 in sea trials, and I believe a 3rd is under construction, which will be the first Chinese-designed aircraft carrier, as I recollect. Washington expects that more bases, Chinese bases, will follow. This is not to say that China is ready to take on the role as global policeman. The Chinese Communist Party has for years painstakingly attempted to craft a narrative of China's peaceful rise, contrasting it with the conflict-laden past few decades of U.S. foreign policy. Beijing's strategic priorities also remain focused on its maritime near abroad over Taiwan, the South China Sea, and the East China Sea. So China is unlikely to make the same mistakes on military interventions in Afghanistan as did the British, Soviets, and Americans. Nevertheless, the U.S. withdrawal from Kabul as well as Baghdad and drawdowns elsewhere is creating a very different strategic picture when viewed from Beijing. With growing overseas interests and unstable, ungoverned areas near China's western frontier, the calculations for Chinese security interventions may be shifting. It is yet to be seen if the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan will be followed by similar Chinese adventurism, one might call it, I suppose, counter-adventurism. The country's economic interests there are few, save for a concession on a $4 billion U.S. dollar copper mine, the world's second largest, that has been stalled for a decade. And while Beijing is very keen to ensure Afghanistan under the Taliban does not become a training ground for extremists, or more importantly, Uyghur separatist militants, it has proactively engaged diplomatically with the Taliban to gain assurances of that very fact. Still, it is now clear for Beijing that in Afghanistan, as elsewhere in the world, it must increasingly shoulder the security burden itself. Its free ride is over. So I want to reemphasize, this is an opinion piece. Mm-hmm. It does kind of concur with some points I made over the last few weeks. Afghanistan touches a lot of borders, and mm-hmm. it's a radical Islamic regime that wants to export its ideology to other places. And those other places, even if they're Muslim, don't want that violent ideology exported. So you've got Tajikistan and Pakistan and other Muslim nations adjacent, even Iran for that matter. They don't necessarily want this kind of radical ideology crossing their borders and creating, let's say, chaos, generally speaking.
Yeah.
So I think it puts China as a rising power, an expansionist power, in my opinion, a neocolonialist power, in my opinion, but one that's trying very hard to put on a peaceful face. It puts them in a really interesting place historically and geopolitically. Andrew?
Well, I agree with the article that it's unlikely that China will try to take the same approach that the U.S. has to international security. I think it's pretty obvious that approach benefits the larger country in the mix as at the expense of the smaller country, and often leads to collapse and humiliating retreat when most of the smaller country's resources have been extracted. I don't think China is interested in that kind of economic expansion plan, at the very least, because it's not sustainable. If you cut all the trees in a forest down, and you don't dig out all the stumps and everything, you end up with nothing there that can regrow. I expect border security and claim defense to be given more priority from China.
Well, I'm going to make a quick historical analogy here because there's really a couple more stories we want to get to. If you envision the situation between the United States and Mexico in the early 1900s, where the Mexican Revolution was ongoing, and at one point Pancho Villa invaded a small town across the border in the U.S. in New Mexico, I believe it was, and the United States sent an expeditionary, what they called an expeditionary force under John Pershing, into Mexico, where they basically tooled around for, I don't know, a few months or a year trying to catch Pancho Villa. They never did. But I can imagine a scenario sort of like this for the Chinese, where they might have the Taliban crossing over into the Uyghur province of China and feel compelled to send an expeditionary force in to punish or contain the groups that came into China and raided. So it's really a scenario that is not hard to envision, even if China is not thinking about doing it. They may feel compelled at some point.
Interesting. I can't deny that it's possible. I think we just have to wait and see where things go.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also hear the show on kpft.org live online, podcast at my suggestion, or you can visit archive.kpft.org and listen to this show and many other shows that have been broadcast previously on KPFT that you might enjoy. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on the show posts and more at the top of the page, find the post for the show or show date you're looking for, or type keywords, which I do all the time to find shows that go back 10 years. We're also on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. Look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, and Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and spelled the same on Tumblr at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Okay, a couple of quick stories to wrap up. From TheGuardian.com, China sends 19 aircraft into Taiwan's air defense zone. Sortie by People's Liberation Army Air Force includes fighter jets and bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons. China's military sent 19 aircraft into Taiwan's air defense identification zone on Sunday. The sortie by People's Liberation Army Air Force was one of the largest in weeks. The area is not technically Taiwan's territorial airspace, but the sorties provoked Taiwan's Air Force to scramble jets in response. And on Sunday, missile monitoring systems were also deployed. In recent weeks, military vessels from the U.S. and the U.K. have also sailed through the region, what they call freedom of navigation trips or missions, with a U.S. warship and a U.S. Coast Guard cutter going through the Taiwan Strait. The Taiwan Strait and nearby South China and East China Seas are geopolitically sensitive. Beijing considers Taiwan to be a province of China under what it calls the One China Principle and has not ruled out the use of force to reunite it. It considers the Tsai Ing-wen-led Taiwanese government to be separatist. Tsai's administration maintains that Taiwan is already an independent state. By the way, that's news to me. I thought that they'd kept that ambiguous.
Yeah,
The U.S. maintains a policy that does not guarantee or rule out coming to Taiwan's defense in the event of an attack. Japan has also become increasingly vocal with its concerns over the China threat. Its deputy prime minister remarked in July that an attack on Taiwan could be considered an existential threat to Japan, which would trigger constitutional permissions for the country to engage militarily. So this is why every once in a while I come up with the sense that we're like in a pre-war period, like the 1930s. Sometimes you just kind of get that impression regurgitating back up like gastric reflux, if that's a metaphor I may use.
Well, I point out that, you know, this was on the eve of Taipei's annual War Games exercises. And that's really what I latched onto about this article. War Games, in view of a rival country, to me, are really just provocation. It's the same in the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. forces in the South show their teeth, and then the North mobilizes to warn them off. Everyone backs down. But if anything had gone wrong, things could have kicked off. It's just not worth the risk. You want maximum preparedness? Go practice in an ally's waters or territory. That, or just leave the ships in port for a while. Maybe people calm down enough to talk to each other.
Well, of course, to do that, though, that would mean essentially stripping your country of military protection while you're exporting it to another place that isn't provocative, which is not provocative, but tempting.
Surely you don't need all your stuff anyway.
Yeah, that's, we're going to be talking about this, I'm sure. As time goes by. Okay, in what I call my curmudgeon moment, the trouble with airports and how to fix them was an article in the New York Times with subtitles like The Quiet Airport Movement, Biophilic Design, Humanizing Airports, Conjuring a Sense of Place. From my point of view, you want to talk about humanizing airports? Airports now have so much walking, and it is by design. Kiosks and shops are rented out, and moving sidewalks have literally been removed to force you to pass vendors. Some passageways are now winding, forcing you to pass more shopping opportunities, but also more walking. The sheer number of gates can involve walking miles inside of an airport. The whole experience is just debilitating. If there is a hell, and if I go to it, it might be an international airport where the security line requires you to get naked after an interminable wait. Your airplane is always at the last and furthest gate. Your plane's departure is delayed, and you're in the last boarding group. And when you deplane, baggage claim is a 3-mile walk, and your baggage is then in the last carousel where you wait 30 minutes for the first bags to appear. Andrew?
Here's that accessibility discussion I mentioned earlier. You make definitely a lot of good points, but in my view, these problems mostly come down to capitalism. Surprise, surprise. It's cheaper when you make airports bigger to handle more flights to not install these accessibility features. Long hallways mean more retail space. Annoying boarding practices are efficient for selling first-class tickets. See CGP Gray's YouTube video, The Better Boarding Method Airlines Won't Use. A $13 grilled cheese sandwich is because you can't go anywhere else. Profit is the problem. However, with the exception of inaccessibility, I find an odd charm in airports and air travel. It's a weird realm where all these things are not only normal but expected. Everywhere looks the same. An hour and a minute both pass slowly. Add the excitement of literally being thousands of feet up in the air and going to see a new place, and it's intoxicating in its own way. I miss airports.
It's intoxicating in first class where you have unlimited alcoholic beverages.
In
coach, it's mostly just excruciatingly painful to your spine.
I think it's great both ways. Anyway, I agree that airports can be better, and they should be better. And I say that because I love them.
Okay, difference of opinion. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, and guy who likes to laugh at some of my jokes, Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed this show and that you have found it interesting, and we will look forward to speaking with you again next week. Take care.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late.
It's time to holler down the pipe chase and rattle them bars.
The Prison Show airs Fridays 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT, For over 40 years, each two-hour program uses an hour to discuss issues and organizations of importance to prisoners and their families to help educate and inform our listeners. The second hour broadcasts shout-outs, live calls from inmates' family and friends so inmates can hear their loved ones speaking on the air. For over 40 years, the show has connected Texas prison inmates with their friends and loved ones over the airwaves. You can't find an older Texas show, and it's right here on KPFT every Friday, 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM, KPFT, or online at kpft.org. Houston's Community Station.
Good morning, Houston. This is your forecast for KPFT. For today, sunny with a high near 95. For your Wednesday night, isolated showers, but mostly clear with a low around 74. And for your Thursday, sunny with a high near 95. This is your forecast for KPFT. Have a great morning, Houston. 95. This is your forecast for KPFT. Have a great morning, Houston. 95.